FBI Studio. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Roth. This is it. This is the end of the trial. In today's episode, you're going to hear the last thing that the jury heard. We've reached the conclusion of this six-week-long trial, and I'm going to do something a little bit different today. This season, in a lot of ways, has been very different from previous seasons, but in a lot of ways, it's been the same. Once all the evidence is out on the table, and the prosecution's case has been crumbling apart in front of your eyes, those that still believe that Robert and Christian are guilty, which I want to be clear, is okay. It's fine for people to come to those different conclusions. But some of those people refuse to believe that anyone could see the evidence any differently than they see it. So they go back to the tired old argument, well, that's because Bob is biased. Bob is not presenting the prosecution's case. But those of you that have been paying attention know that I've presented to you the entirety of the prosecution's case. You've heard everything they presented at trial. You've seen all the evidence. I've asked those people what elements that I've missed do they want to be covered, and I covered them. You've heard it all, and today, you're literally going to hear it all. Normally, when going through trial transcripts of any kind, I break them down and I share my thoughts along the way. I'm not going to do that today. Today, I'm just going to let you hear what the jury heard exactly the way they heard it. I'm going to read to you every word of Ackie's final rebuttal in its entirety. There can be no question, there can be no spin. This is how the state made their case to the jury. This is season 12, episode 60, The State's Final Word.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Everything you hear from this point forward are not my words. What you're going to hear is Ackie's words. I'll be playing the part of him and reading directly from the trial transcript. Here we go. Ackie takes the podium, and the first thing he does is address the jurors. Did you have a nice big lunch or a little lunch? Juror number three responds, little. Then back to Ackie. Little, thank you. I'm with you for just a little bit longer. I apologize for the length of time it has taken. I think on behalf of all counsel here at the table, we thank you for your time. Now, I feel a little beat up because all I heard is them referring to me and what I've done and the case that we presented. And I'm like, bam, bam, like a boxer going 12 rounds. Start feeling a little sore. And I start thinking, well, what can I tell this jury that they don't already know? So I thought about this and I said, you know what? Let me tell you about when my son was 2 years old, my youngest. He liked Curious George. And he got this Curious George doll that spoke. But the speaker box had something wrong with it. When you pressed it, it was supposed to say, ha 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 hey. Sometimes it would say, ha 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 hell. One day I'm listening to him through the, you know, you have these things in your bedroom that connects to speakers in their room so you can listen to them and what they're saying. And he's in there playing with his doll. I know he is. And he says to himself, ha 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 hey, or ha 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 hell. Well, which is it? That's from a 2-year-old. And now I listen to the defense for the past day and a half, and I have to ask myself the same question. Well, which is it? I spent the better part of yesterday morning, probably an hour, I think, telling you a full and complete story of what happened, the truth, The truth based on the evidence presented. Not evidence that was made up, not evidence that was reinvented or mischaracterized or misleading. Represented you with the whole story. I'm glad Mr. Moore talked about the fact that there is a process, what your job is. Your job is the seeker of the truth. Your job is to find that truth. Our job is to present the evidence. But a part of that job is law enforcement to go out and put together a case. And then we take that case and we hand it all over to the defense. So in large part, they know exactly what we know. They knew the strengths, they knew the weaknesses. When they talk to you and tell you that, why hasn't the prosecution brought in all these witnesses, all the family members of the defendants, people who might have seen them at home, why didn't we? Well, if they had something important to say, the defense would have brought them in just as well. Because we have equal access to this. This is not trial by surprise. This is not one where we say, aha, I got you. Everyone knows what's coming. So I thought it odd that Mr. Moore would end his closing argument by saying, I tricked you. I tricked you, and then telling you to ignore evidence and disregard evidence that you know to be true. And Mr. Dolan got up here and started to give you a standard that no one can reach. A standard of proof that no one can reach. That somehow law enforcement is tasked with getting every single piece of evidence, every single item tested, talked to every single witness. And then Mr. Moore got up here and said, well, they didn't do any of that. You should disbelieve them. Except that when the prosecution does do that, when we do retest things, when we go out and find evidence, when we do re-examine pieces of evidence, when we do re-interview people, they say, well, they shouldn't be doing that. They shouldn't be doing this years afterwards. This case should have stopped in 2006, and you should only go with what evidence you had. But as you remember from jury selection, we talked about this. Murder has no statute of limitations. Do you, as members of the community, expect our law enforcement officers to simply stop when they hit a roadblock? Do you? Is that what you expect from people investigating a murder? But that's what they want you to believe. I'm not going to sit up here and try to rebut every single piece of evidence they put up here or argument that they made. That's ridiculous. We'd be here for another day and a half. Now, by show of hands, how many of you want to be here another day and a half listening to lawyers? I take it that no one raised their hands. Thank you very much. So let me try to get through this. The things that the defense relies on are for you to reserve and leave your common sense behind. To not think about the world as a whole. To not think about your own life and what this means and what you heard in this room. But quite the opposite. The law requires you to come in with your experiences and what you knew about this world, and that's what we're going to spend some time talking about. You know that technology has advanced. You know that steam engines turned into now autonomous driving cars, although they have some problems with those, right? Telegrams are now emails. Cell tower movements and what side of the cell tower you're on, does it really matter if you don't know how far you are? We know today that a GPS device can track you. You can track your children. I didn't know that till about 2 days ago. That's kind of a good thing to have, by the way. You know that we went from Thomas Brothers, right, to Garmin, to now we use MapQuest and Google Earth. We know that mapping the human genome and figuring out a person's identity from either, you know, biological samples, touch DNA, what have you, we can do that. Not 10 years ago, maybe, we were able to determine whether or not this person was male or female, and now you can tell the person's eye color. You can tell the person's race. You can tell a lot, and that's only within the last 10 years. So is it so hard for you to believe, then, that when we take a fingerprint and send it to the DOJ, that they come back and they are able to identify the prints? We can do that on our phones right now. And is it so hard to believe that an FBI agent can come in here today in 2018 and say from a partial shoe print, I can tell you the size now? Is that so hard to believe? If you take individual pieces of evidence that were presented in this case, it's easy to poke holes in anything, right? For instance, if you just listen to Mr. Smith's statement, wow. He's telling the truth, right? He went home and he was there all night, until you consider it with the rest of the evidence, and that's your job. His statement means nothing until you look at the phone records. You look at his movement patterns. You look at the DNA. You look at the fact that there are shoe prints in the sand, too. You look at the wheelbarrow. You look at the planned hike. You should never look at anything when you're searching for the truth in a vacuum. That's not how the world works, and I know you know that. One of the things that you need to be concerned about is, and I saw a couple of you writing this down when Mr. Dolan put this up there, and this was his timeline of Christian Smith, then he directed you to page and line where these things are located. And, you know, the most dangerous kind of untruth is those that are mixed in with the truth. Because some of you may have written that down thinking, this is gospel. I should be able to take this down and write it all down and say, yeah, that's where that's at, and I don't have to do any further investigation. Until you actually look at what it says. And that's what we hope you will do, to take a look at the evidence. And you take a look at this call to Sacred Heart Church. He puts it at 7:03. These are the actual phone records of Robert Pape when he calls 411 at 7 o'clock. And we're going to blow that up for just a second. You see there at 1944, he's hitting off Tower 707. That's in Robert Pape's area of coverage. And as we slide that over, you see that it was Robert Pape's call to 411. Remember in his statement, I'm calling 411 to get Sacred Heart's number. That lasts for 62 seconds. The very next line up at 7:01, if we go back, 1901 is 7:01 p.m., you slide that over, he's still in Tower 707. He makes a call to Sacred Heart Church, and you heard that from Special Agent Bowles. That lasts for 33 seconds. So that's a minute and a half. You see there, 62 seconds and 33? For a minute and a half, that's how long it takes for him to know that church has been canceled. But why does Mr. Dolan want you to believe that that call was at 7:03? And then you go back and you look at this chart there. And he says at 7:10, they are headed back towards Christian's house. So what he just did was he gave himself 13 minutes lead time right now, or 12 minutes lead time, right, to get back to Christian's house. But if you go to that page 22 in line, page 12, line 22 of Mr. Smith's statement, this is what line 21 says. Quote, and they said, like, they only had church at 5:30 that day, so I guess we missed it. And I'm like, crap, we're going to do, what are we going to do now? So we drove back to my house, end quote. Does it say anywhere there that it was 7:10? Let's go to the 7:45, page 12, line 3, or line 26, I'm sorry. Quote, yeah, we're sitting in, and then we just sat around and played, you know, like we played, watched some TV in my room. My room's over there. End quote. He wanted you to write down those numbers, and I believe that that was the time and directed you to what looked like, hey, that's evidence. It's in here. It's got to be true, and there's nothing there. Why would he mislead you like that? Why would he want to extend the time for them to drive around the valley and then go back home? Another thing is, look at the time difference between 7:10 and 7:45. Mr. Moore got up here and told you it doesn't take that long to get to Christian's house. That's 35 minutes. That's more than enough time because that's the amount of time it takes to drive from Pinyon Pines down to Mr. Smith's house. Why would he mislead you? I don't fault him for that. I don't fault Mr. Moore for engaging in the certain defense tactics that they have to. They represent their clients, and I appreciate that. You should too. But they have a job to do. So these are some of the things that I wanted to point out to you here. Mr. Moore talked about, and again, I'm not going to go through everything, but he talked about Javier Garcia. And Javier Garcia, when he was up at the crime scene, he probably misspoke when he said that. He said Javier Garcia was up there at 8:30. But you know Investigator Bumpensero and or LeClaire said he was up there at 12:37. I don't know. But intimating that Javier Garcia somehow got the information about the crime scene. Do you remember that? But we agreed that these are the facts because they are true and uncontested. That Rebecca Friedley at 8:12 a.m. on September 18th was processed and sealed into a body bag. That Vicky at 12:45 was placed into a body bag. And at 2:23, John Hayward was placed into a body bag and sealed. How then? And here Moore objects. Objection. Misstates the stipulation as to when they were placed in the body bag. Aki. Deceased victims were sealed into a body bag for transportation. Did I miss that part? The judge. Well, the stipulation speaks for itself. So again, ladies and gentlemen, that's part of the evidence. And whatever is written in that stipulation, whatever is contained in that stipulation, are facts that you must abide by. Now back to Ackie's closing. How then would Robert Pape know this part? Quote, a female about 20 years old in the wheelbarrow, end quote. Well, it's from Tim Summerlee, obviously, right? Except remember what Tim Summerlee said and where he was standing when he observed what he observed about the wheelbarrow. Quote, I saw what appeared to be a mannequin. I don't know what sex. I saw what appeared to be a mannequin, end quote. Mr. Dolan got up here and started to talk to you about the DNA. The DNA is on Becky's socks. Those are your killers. And he reminded me from a scene from My Cousin Vinny. I like that movie, where the prosecutor gets up and says, quote, identical, right? The big moment. Quote, excluded. He's excluded, right? On the one side of his mouth, he says, you should believe this exclusionary portion of the DNA. You should believe that they are excluded. But when his client is included in the business card, oh, you can't believe that. Don't look here. That's called a double standard defense, okay? You should be aware of that when you're considering and thinking about what the defense tried to proffer here today. He forgot. Mr. Dolan forgot that in the real world, in real world scenarios, the DNA is everywhere, right? Ms. Giamanco told you how that is. That wherever you go, wherever you walk, wherever people live, they shed DNA. Whether it's your skin, saliva, sweat, hair, kind of gross, right? The sound of it. Many of you have walked through your house, right? And you track DNA into this courtroom based on what Ms. Giamanco says, and that's true. It just depends on whether or not there is a detectable amount, right? So think about what Becky did that night when she was getting ready. And think about the people who were in her environment at the time. John Hayward, Vicki Friedley. Her friends Javier and Bo Nash were up at the house. Friends who have come up in the past. Ron Friedley was up there at some point in time. A bunch of people would have come and gone. John Hayward's son Robbie might have been up there in the past before the 17th. And think about your own life when you walk around your house, right? You get out of the shower. You get ready. Do you automatically put your shoes on? Maybe. Maybe you don't. Maybe you walk around. Maybe you start picking things up. And all that DNA says is that I am collecting DNA from my environment. What should be concerning to you is when a foreign contaminant is in that environment, when something doesn't belong there. And as you can tell, I'm probably a big fan of certain TV and movie shows. But Mr. Rogers. How many of you remember Mr. Rogers? Yeah. He used to have the jingle, right? One of these things is not like the other. One of these things does not belong. When we look at all of the evidence that's here, and we look at the DNA that's present, and again, they have the same evidence, so they know this, what are we saying when we exclude people? That there are people in that environment that belong, or there is DNA there that we simply don't know. Because you will never hear that there are other profiles developed, just that these are partial profiles that cannot determine who they are. We can say that we can use them for exclusionary purposes, we can exclude people, and that's what happened to Mr. Smith and Mr. Pape. Their arguments about the wheelbarrow and the wheelbarrow handles also seems to be a little misleading. And you know this because you find DNA, right? On one wheelbarrow handle for exclusionary purposes. But there's no DNA on the right wheelbarrow handle. Well, what does that say? That there was a one-handed person pushing that wheelbarrow all the time through the life of that wheelbarrow? Or that somehow DNA on everyone's right hand in the world, or whoever touched that, won't leave DNA? Or maybe it says that the wheelbarrow was introduced to water and foam, and we just can't tell. Those are things that you have to consider and look at. And in searching for the truth, don't be misled. Remember, you live in the real world and not in the fake world that is created by the defense. Mr. Smith's presence in Becky's world should not have been there. Mr. Smith told you, I'd never been up there, except for the 17th, because his DNA should not have been introduced to her world, especially on a card. Mr. Pape, he should not be in that world at this point in time too, right? He broke up with Becky. Hadn't been up there since they had broken up. Listen and read his statement. That's what he says. That card should not be up there either because it connects him to this crime as well. You were exposed to what I call the kitchen sink approach. They throw everything up against the wall like spaghetti pasta. I don't know if you ever did this to make sure your spaghetti pasta was ready, When you throw it against the wall, if it's stuck, then it was good to go, right? They want you to see the world in a vacuum, which means you take a look at each individual piece of evidence to the exclusion of everything else. That's just not the way the world works. Because Mr. Pape's records don't mean anything without the fact that he said, "I was with Mr. Smith all night." So then Mr. Smith's records have to be taken into account and connected to that and evaluated together. When you see that their cell phones go dark together. You can't take the DNA evidence in a vacuum unless you know why it's up there and what this business card represents and who it is connected to. You have to be careful of the double standard defense. One of the things Mr. Dolan claimed yesterday was somehow he had taken this card and submitted it to HIT Laboratories, right? It's the first laboratory that saw this card, right? They got DNA, right? And then we submitted it to two other labs. What happened to that card? Ms. Giamanco told you this, and you have a stipulation from Marixa Scott. And I don't know if I have this here, but there was a photograph taken of this card. And this is how everyone knows the processing. And this is why I think it's disingenuous for all of us who know the evidence, for one of us to get up here and say, "Well, why didn't they submit that business card to Ms. Flores to determine whether the prints were correct or not? Or these were Christian Smith's prints?" But you heard how the process goes. Marixa Scott takes the card, she dusts it for prints, she introduces the ninhydrin, she pulls off the fingerprints, she photographs it, and then you heard what happened to it next. It goes to the DNA analyst. They take water, they wipe it with a swab, and this, on the card, it happens three times before 2018. So as much DNA as they could get off of it. But that also destroys the fingerprint. So it's disingenuous, and knowing that this is the process, disingenuous to come up here and tell you that they should have submitted the card to the DOJ because that's the best evidence. No, ladies and gentlemen. The process is you take a photograph of it, and that's what everyone else uses. Because we know we're going to swab for DNA, and that destroys the fingerprint. But that was another misleading statement that was provided to you. And then to take pot shots at Ms. Flores and to basically engage in character assassination for her taking these photographs and uploading it into new technology and to look at the prints side by side and say there's a match, that, ladies and gentlemen, is misleading and it should not be considered by you. Mr. Dolan said it's been 12 years. Memories fade. I think he was relating to the fact that the DA's office and law enforcement agencies went out and continued to try to interview people to get their memories back on track to use time and events in their lives to figure out what actually was the story. But you should know that DNA, call detail records, the fingerprints, and the lies recorded by the defendants in their statements and interviews to law enforcement don't fade. Some of the things that Mr. Dolan said in his opening was this. You should try to remember this is not evidence. Certainly our opening statements were not evidence, but you have to wonder, well, what happened? Mr. Summerlee will not say, and the evidence will not support, that he saw the wheelbarrow. And here Moore objects again. "I'm going to object. This is improper." The judge, overruled. Moore, "It's not evidence." The judge, "Well, opening statements, closing arguments are not evidence by the lawyers. It's true. Neither are their questions. Only the stipulations are evidence and statements made by the lawyers. Only what came from the witness stand and any exhibits are evidence. So with that said, Mr. Ackey," now we're back to the closing, "that he saw the wheelbarrow, will not say the wheelbarrow had any flames. He said that with regard to the drive time, it's impossible to get to the valley floor. That no one will come in here and say that the trace evidence matches Christian Smith. You will hear from a defense expert who will say that it is impossible, not just unlikely, impossible that those ping points along traveling up the road to the crime scene can be projected. He said that because the phone didn't hold a charge, and when you were not using your phone, you turned it off back in 2006. Kevin Bowles told you, no, actually it held the charge longer because they are not smartphones. They're not like the supercomputers you have in each of your pockets. And you will hear Mr. Smith's statement that after he came back, and he's referring to the statement that we played in court, and he played in court, that his phone was off. And did you see that? You will hear from a DNA expert about the proper protocol and that it was not followed for DNA to be tested and to preserve that evidence for future tests to take place. And you heard that that was not true. He then said and talked about this red truck. Honestly, there's not much to say about it other than it's a red herring, not a red truck. They spent a lot of time, Mr. Moore and Mr. Dolan, trying to distance themselves from the business card and then from the business card to the crime scene at the Freedley residence. Why do you think that is? Again, if you take it by itself, each individual thing, yeah, maybe, right? Mr. Dolan made a big deal about the fact that you only have 5 photographs of shoe prints, and you might think, yeah, where are the other 160 shoe prints? But would that make any difference if I showed you 160 of the same shoe prints in the sand, would it, in your analysis? And you're looking at the wheelbarrow tracks, and he told you they are not consistent. No, given the terrain and what the sandy conditions were like, in some areas there were tracks, in other areas there were not. What would 160 other photographs of shoes have done for you? We talked about these 2 gas cans. There are the gas cans that are upstairs. And while I enjoyed their tortured logic throughout their arguments, that gas can is over there on the left corner, left quadrant. It tells you what happened based on the burn patterns and where those gas cans are located. Those would have been the gas cans that are most relevant to this case. Why was DNA not found, or prints not found, or any type of evidence processed from that? What do you think the fire did to those cans? They took those cans, they poured it upstairs, they ran out of gas, they threw it there, walked back downstairs, and lit the place on fire. That's what the evidence shows. Mr. Dolan talked about the fact that, listen, why didn't they have Jackie Mudo in here or anyone else come in and testify that he smelled like gas when he got back from the crime scene, right? Now, Mr. Smith tells you himself what happened, that after that night when he dropped Robert off, he went back home and took a shower. When you mix in the truth with the lies, you have to decipher what the truth is and why these things would be true in the totality of the entire case, not just evidence in a vacuum. I ask you to bear with me for just a minute longer. And finally, did I miss something? Oh, I might have. Let me just do this. They talked a lot about Tim Summerlee and what he saw and how that might have applied to their mystery unicorn killer who shut the garage door, lit the place on fire after Mr. Summerlee walked downstairs and ran off through the desert. Except that as you heard from Ron Freedley and Tiffany Teasdale, you can't see into the house from the garage. They tried to make a big deal about this garage being up or down. In your minds, does it really matter whether the springs failed? That's the most likely scenario given the heat and the fire above the garage. Look at the destruction above the garage. You can't tell me that that place, that the garage wasn't so hot that it would cause those springs on that heavy door to fall down. Mr. Moore also talked to you about this idea that somehow, and Mr. Dolan too as well, that they were driving along the valley floor. And that explains the behavior of their cell tower records of where they were. They weren't driving up to Pinyon Pines. They were driving around going to church, which again, you saw was not true. But this is Tower 523. This is the one piece of evidence. 2, not one. There are several. But this is one of the more important pieces of evidence that they cannot explain. We saw during the course of this trial where Sacred Heart was located. It's that circle or that dot with the circle around it in pencil. Moore chimes in, what exhibit is that? Aki, it's a diagram. It's not in evidence. But there's one like that up there because Mr. Moore introduced it. I just did not know where that exhibit was, but that's where it is. There is absolutely no, Moore jumps in again. Objection, Your Honor. Counsel's testifying and creating evidence, apparently. The judge. Well, it's an exhibit being used during, or a piece of evidence being used during the course of closing argument that has not been admitted, it's true. But obviously, lawyers are allowed to make argument with respect to whatever. There is apparently another exhibit that is similar in nature that is located within the exhibits that have been admitted. So this will not be admitted, what's being shown, but there is an exhibit apparently that is similar in nature. And back to Aki's closing. You will find on the exhibits and evidence that there's absolutely no way for them to be in 523 and their phones behave in the way they behaved on the 17th of September 2006. And then they spent some time attacking Mr. Witt. Mr. Smith told you in the beginning, he said, look, you're going to hear things about Jeremy Witt from the defense because we all know him because everyone has the same evidence. You should believe it. He was right. Mr. Witt has a bad background. Better than some, worse than others. But what does he tell you that's important to this case? I talked to you a little bit about it, and Mr. Moore reminded me of something, and I thought about it too as well. If you choose to believe his evidence, you can or you don't have to, it's up to you, but if you choose to, what he is telling you are a couple of things. One, we were up there. It all went wrong, and we torched the place. So two people. The other thing about that is a little more. I think something you'll have to think about as you start reviewing the law of first and second degree murder. But it makes sense, and that's up for you to evaluate. But what happened on the 17th of September 2006 is that there was a planned hike. Maybe the defendants planned to kill them. Maybe they didn't. But they had guns accessible. Maybe it's because that's when they went shooting in the desert with Chad Birnbaum, you know, on prior occasions. They had gone shooting with other friends, Sam Geyer. But they went up to the desert, up to Pinyon Pines, to Becky Friedley's, to go for a hike. There's evidence that they went for a hike. Then something went wrong. We don't know, we can't speculate. But we can certainly deduce from the evidence that something did go wrong. There was that struggle out in the desert, 200 yards away on this hike. That struggle was the thing that went wrong. Maybe what they went up there to talk about was their relationship, and Robert didn't like what he had to hear, or what Becky had to say. And then it all went wrong. And that, ladies and gentlemen, could be the reason why you come back with a second-degree murder for Miss Friedley, for Becky, as horrific as it is. Then they take her body back there. But now they know they have to take care of the other two people because they know she went on a hike with them. And so they murdered John and Vicky because they wanted to get away with this murder. And that is premeditated, willful, and deliberate first-degree murder. I wrote a whole bunch of stuff in here. I won't go over all of it. I do appreciate your time and the time you spent with us and the efforts you're going to go through when you go back in there. What everyone here deserves is your ability to go in there and look at the evidence in a careful and considerate and objective manner. With regards to what the law is in this area, there are a couple of things. There are a couple of cornerstones of our justice system. I talked to you about that in jury selection. The burden of proof is reasonable doubt. It's highlighted there in your jury instructions. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you with an abiding conviction that the charge is true, and that's after a careful consideration of all the evidence. This is the most important part when you're considering a circumstantial evidence case, this next line. The evidence need not eliminate all possible doubt because everything in life is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. Now, when Mr. Moore got up here and started telling you his story, and I bet some of you thought, wow, this is going to be interesting. They're going to tell us their side of the story. Until he told you that it was a trick. Until he told you that it was imaginary. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not about imaginary. You can't interject things that possibly could have happened or might have happened and invent your own story. You have to follow the evidence, each in combination with the other. Take a look at what the evidence tells you and what the truth is, because that's your job. The search is for the truth. And not, as Mr. Dolan explained, the search is for you to find them innocent. You also, with regards to circumstantial evidence, need to know this, that when you consider circumstantial evidence, you must accept only the reasonable conclusions and reject any unreasonable. So I leave you with this. What reasonable interpretation of the evidence did the defendants tell you there were? When you put all the evidence together, what is their reasonable interpretation? They have none. Sure, they can take bits and pieces of the evidence and say, oh, look over here, look over there. The DNA says this about my client. It's excluded. And there's all these other people. But when it relates to my client, don't believe it. Or look over here. Look over here at the cell tower evidence. Look, they're driving around the Coachella Valley and they are hitting all these towers. That's not true. Well, look over here. Look at my client's statements. You should believe them when they say they were here. But yet when you look at their statements together, the lies are apparent. The truth is there for you to find. Tell yourself, what was the one reasonable story they told you? Any reasonable story about what happened there, given the state of the evidence? Not one. And we provided you with the truth. The truth is Robert Pape and Christian Smith were up in Pinyon Pines on the 17th of September, 2006. That's proven beyond a reasonable doubt. They were either killers or they were victims. And you know, as they are sitting here, they weren't victims. I ask you to go back there and follow your oath. Search for the truth. I'm confident you'll come back with guilty verdicts on both defendants. Thank you. And there it is. Those were the final words that the jury heard before they went into their deliberations. And we'll talk about what it all means and your thoughts on it in this week's Friday Follow-Up. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Edited by Kelly Barron's Brink and sound engineered by Shane Yoder. All music for the show was created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. All of our fonts across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design, and you can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Kay Woodyomnik, Ginger Fiola, Erica Cantor, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Ford, Courtney Wimberly, and Melissa Cardenas. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in several ways. To financially support the show, the best thing you can do is just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You'll not only be supporting the show, but you'll get something in return. On Patreon, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes bonus video content every week. Then other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also do us a huge favor by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the brands that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page on Facebook. And for all you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. And I can be found personally on all forms of social media @BobRuffTruth. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.